Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Yeah, the happenings inside the arena are interesting. What is outside, though, is just as important. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today, the 19th of July. Great, as always, to have you along, everybody. Today is Economic Policy Day at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. Economic policy, that is, once everybody stops talking about the news from last night, Melania Trump's speech, of course. We, however, are going to stay in our lane, taking you outside the Quicken Loans arena to see how what's going on inside is playing. That is our theme of the week. Insiders and outsiders in politics and culture, and especially in the economy. Our Washington Bureau Chief, Andrea Seabrook, starts us off.
Two young guys take in the crazy party scene outside the convention.
I'm Conrad Archom Schultz.
I'm Sam Ditzhazy.
This fall, they'll vote for the first time. They're 18 and 22 years old. And these are Trump's true believers.
Well, he's great for jobs. He's great for the economy. He's a American patriot. I mean, he's American.
Everything he's touched has turned to gold. His businesses, everything he's done has been successful.
Does it bother you guys at all that Trump is sort of not totally in with the rest of the Republican Party?
No. That's actually why he's doing so great, is because the thing is, politics in America is just, it's so corrupt, it's so crony, hence the Obama and the Clinton administration.
For Sam and Conrad, it's a great thing that Trump isn't a GOP insider. That makes him their hero. So they wander on down the street, packed with people hawking convention merch, looking for the perfect T-shirt to fly the Trump colors. In Cleveland, I'm Andrea Seabrook.
And I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer. I met a very different kind of Republican outside the convention. His name is George Zinn. He's in his 60s. And his T-shirt says, "Stop Trump. Stop Hillary." I asked him why he wants to stop Trump.
I'm not so concerned about his ability to run the country as far as getting us out of debt and things like that. I think he's very money conscious. What I'm concerned about is his personality.
So if Trump, assuming Trump's the nominee, are you going to vote for him?
In November? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll vote for him. I won't vote for Hillary, certainly not. But if it came right down to Bernie Sanders and Trump, now I might do a little fasting and praying on that issue.
That's an example of how the poles of American politics are shifting. Those in will still vote for Donald Trump. He's conflicted. In Cleveland, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
There is plenty more convention coverage on our new pop-up podcast that Andrea is running. It's called Politics Inside Out, all about that gap between insiders and outsiders in politics and in this economy. Subscribe wherever you choose, actually, or at marketplace.org/inside out. All right, so now on to the Republican Party platform, a non-binding but symbolically important representation of the ideals and objectives of any given political party, which is why it was a bit of a surprise to see Republicans calling for the reinstatement of the Glass-Steagall Act in their big political grand plan, capital B, capital P, capital G, capital P again. Republicans are more typically associated with deregulation, for one, and also Glass-Steagall is a Depression-era banking regulation that was a big part of Bernie Sanders' campaign and also is part of draft versions of the Democratic Party platform. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reminds us why, after all these years, Glass-Steagall is still a hot topic.
Glass-Steagall just keeps coming up, so much so that one Marketplace staffer actually gave another a small glass seagull, the bird, as a sort of gag gift because, well, that's the kind of humor we have around here. Glass-Steagall, the regulation, not the bird, was passed after the stock market crash of 1929. Jim Barth is a finance professor at Auburn University.
It was thought that banks should stick basically to their traditional activities, taking in deposits and making loans to businesses or individuals, and stay away from the stock market.
It created this firewall between commercial and investment banking.
A lot of people feel that that was a solid thing to have. It limited the amount of risk that these entities on either side of the fence could take on.
Doug Branson is a law professor at the University of Pittsburgh. Glass-Steagall was basically undone under President Bill Clinton in 1999. And so, for many, calls to reinstate Glass-Steagall represent efforts to make banks simpler, smaller.
It's a return through rose-colored lenses to a simpler, happier time.
Donald Lampson is of counsel at the law firm Squire Patton Boggs. He argues that banks having these different businesses and diverse revenue streams can actually be a good thing. Aaron Klein is a fellow at the Brookings Institution.
When you actually look at the prescriptive policies contained in Glass-Steagall, they don't really make sense in a modern era.
Klein says Glass-Steagall wouldn't have prevented the recent financial crisis. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, one up, two down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Emmy nominations were announced last week, and one company that got quite a few nods was an independent production house called Scott Free Productions, founded by director Ridley Scott and his brother Tony. They were nominated in a couple of different categories for two very different shows, The Good Wife, which just wrapped its last season on CBS, and The Man in the High Castle on Amazon. David Zucker is the president of television for Scott Free, and he is today's guest on Conversations from the Corner Office, Heyday of Television Edition. David, thanks for coming to the studio.
Pleasure to be here.
Before we turned on the microphones, you said a very interesting thing. You have a little cheat sheet in front of you, and I said, what's up with that? And you said, well, we have so many things going on right now that it's tough to keep track. You have said there is an amazing breadth of buyers out here for your stuff. It's sort of the golden age of doing what you do.
It is an extraordinary time in television. I think it is a period in at least this industry that is unprecedented, where anything is truly possible. Subject matter-wise, in terms of talent that's accessible to you, there is really no place you can't go, in addition to which it is a global business now.
Explain to me, to everybody, I guess, who's not familiar with how it works in the land of independent production companies, do you guys come up with stuff and pitch it? Do the networks come to you and say, we want XYZ? How does it work?
It's to use an English term, it's very bespoke in the sense that any of these productions can get put together any number of ways. We can do it the traditional way, which was how Good Wife came into existence. Something like the project that we've just done and we're delivering to Amazon, our first half-hour single-camera production, Jean-Claude Van Damme piece.
There's a name you haven't heard in a while.
That's right. And that was one that, in some ways, was born of the fact that we are looking in a global marketplace now. And Amazon, like Netflix and a few others, who are very cognizant of the appeal for an international audience, responded to that and sort of picked it up out of the gate.
Are you guys platform's the wrong word. I guess network agnostic. I mean, you do PBS with Mercy Street. You did Amazon with, you're doing it with Jean-Claude and also Man in the High Castle.
At Amazon,
Which I want to come back to in a minute. And also traditional with CBS and The Good Wife and numbers before that. You don't care where it goes. You're just going out there.
We're absolutely network agnostic. I mean, the one thing that hasn't changed, I mean, I've been at Scott Free for 15 years now. And the one thing that hasn't changed, even as the business has evolved radically in some respects, is it still begins with the writer. And it still begins with that idea. And then you want to find a home for it that project for Mercy Street, for instance, it is the most important production for PBS, trying to take on an American history project, the likes of which they hadn't done in 12 years.
Not the least of which also should be said is following up Downton Abbey.
That's right. Yeah. And for Man in the High Castle at Amazon, it was a very big swing for them, a project that took us 9 years to find a home for in the U.S. Originally, of all things, we'd sold it to the BBC and then brought it back into the U.S. Amazon didn't exist when we started developing that project.
I get the whole there's never been a better time, right? Because you guys have so many outlets. But is it not also perhaps one of the most competitive times in television?
Well, competitive is one way of putting it. I mean, the way I tend to describe it is there are more possibilities and more opportunities than ever before. There's over 50 buyers, which is frankly extraordinary.
And so when you say buyers, you mean networks or outlets for your stuff?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I know John Landgraf talked about when he spoke with you how
much
greater
sort
of the programming has exploded. But I think as and I'm certainly no television historian, but one who's sort of been riding sort of the wave, so to speak, as sort of the fiscal opportunities internationally in some ways changed, that the studios couldn't necessarily rely upon the output, couldn't rely on the same syndication deals. Obviously, Netflix and Amazon all changed the financial mathematics
right,
of it.
Right.
From a content standpoint, we've been enormous beneficiaries.
All right. Since I have you in the studio, and I'm a huge Man of the High Castle fan, hello, season two, when?
Season two, well, I don't know if they're going to announce it at Comic-Con, but
you can announce it here. It'd be all right.
And get my hands in some other things slapped. But I believe it will be sometime at the end of this year.
All right.
We're halfway into it.
All right. We're going to go with that. David Zucker is the president of television at Scott Free Productions. David, thanks very much.
A pleasure to talk to you. Thanks.
There was a whole lot more of that conversation we didn't have time for on the radio, which is part of why podcasts are awesome. We've got the full version of my chat with David Zucker on our Corner Office podcast. Find it, as I said before, wherever you get your podcasts. Good people at the European Union's Border Agency released some new statistics today. The number of migrants arriving in Greece from Turkey last month was down 95% from a year earlier. That is partly because of the deal that the EU made with Turkey a couple of months ago to send migrants back whence they came. Also, though, it's partly because of tighter border controls that have been imposed by the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. Thing is that hundreds of people have now gotten stuck in Macedonia, and they are being housed in facilities designed only to take care of those passing through. The BBC's Guy Delaney has that story for us.
This is the outdoor canteen at the Tabanovse Transit Center for refugees, and people are just finishing their lunch here on a very hot afternoon as the summer really comes on strong. And that's a problem because this place wasn't designed for a long-term stay. It was designed for people just coming through quickly and getting onto trains and resuming their journey along the so-called Balkan route.
They're getting frustrated and they're getting depressed and they're going through a very difficult psychological state of mind.
Mohamed Arif is the representative in Macedonia for the UN's refugee agency, the UNHCR.
There were about 1,400 here when the borders got closed, and the others have gone. When the restrictions are made tight, what happens is there are other avenues that they would look for. And those avenues could be very dangerous and very difficult ones. Because if you don't have a system, what happens is that then the illegal ways come up and the smugglers' business are booming.
There's a mixture of residents here at Tabanovse, which you can clearly see as you walk around the camp. There are young men on their own. There are family groups. And there's even one newborn baby, just a matter of days old. Lots of families have already left, says Simin Afshar. She's come from Afghanistan with her three children and now newborn Matis. She says she's out of money, but wouldn't pay people smugglers, even if that were an option.
I would not take that risk with my three daughters. I couldn't trust anyone.
One of those daughters, 12-year-old Samira, says she misses school, but she's also seen enough danger to know she's safer here than she was in her hometown of Herat.
In Afghanistan, we did not feel secure. There was fighting every day there. Here we feel safe.
Construction workers are busy making Tabanovse more suitable for longer-term housing. But while some residents are resigned to waiting, those who have money continue to seek out the often callous people smugglers. Human rights lawyer Arben Gudaci advises people at the camp. He says it's a case of desperate people taking considerable risks.
Especially after the border were closed 2 months ago, we can see that they are more vulnerable because they have to go through smugglers through very bad ways. We had an interview with a lot of refugees that were attacked from the population or from smugglers, etc. They were robbed, they were beaten, etc.
The summer of 2015 saw tumultuous scenes in Macedonia. While they may not be repeated, there's still a hidden story on the Balkan route, with thousands of people desperate to reach Western Europe. Some of them are on the move, some of them stuck in camps like Tabanovce, but all of them are determined to get somewhere better.
The BBC's Guy Delaney in Tabanovce, Macedonia for us. Coming up.
My immediate goal is to receive fair compensation for the damage that's going to be done to my ranch.
Don't mess with Texas and don't mess with Texans either. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials on this Tuesday gained 25 points, about a tenth percent, 18,559. At the risk of boring you, this is the Dow's longest winning streak since March of 2013, if you're the type that keeps track of those sorts of things. The NASDAQ gave up 19 points, about a third percent, 5,036. The S&P 500 gave back 3 points, about a tenth percent, 2,163 there. Prospects of slower growth put a damper on most financial shares. Goldman Sachs peeled off more than 1%. Today, Citigroup erased 0.4%. On the earnings front, United Continental tipped up 0.2% in the regular session. Then it reported a better quarter than expected. Shares climbed another 1% after the bell. Ditto Microsoft, down more than 1.5% during the trading day, but jumped 3% after the close. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Olympics in Rio are less than 3 weeks away, and there has been controversy aplenty. Zika, political unrest, water quality, you know the list. Now the International Olympic Committee is talking about banning the entire Russian team from the Games after a massive doping scandal. Marketplace's Andy Euler takes a look at what that's going to mean for the Olympic economy.
Hosting the Olympics is monetarily a losing proposition. Infrastructure costs, security, housing, it all adds up. But there's the prestige of hosting the Games. Rio hasn't even been able to enjoy that. Roger Pilkey Jr. is a professor at the University of Colorado.
Brazil probably should send a big thank you card to the Russians for taking the focus of attention off of the political issues, the infrastructure issues, Zika, leading up to the Games.
But wouldn't an all-out ban of Russia mean less competition, less exciting TV? Joel Maxey teaches sports management at Drexel University. He says NBC, who broadcasts the Games here, probably isn't worried.
I think at the same time, there'll be probably a lot of great stories, new stars, and those sorts of things that will capture the public's imagination, and those things will be pushed and highlighted by the media.
It could also mean more perceived integrity in the Games, which for some sports means the rightful champion will be crowned. That hasn't always been the case. Again, Roger Pilkey Jr.
So in a sense, in these Games, maybe the thinking is that, you know, without the Russians there, there's more of a chance for athletes who went about things the right way to actually get on the medal stand.
That means endorsements, money, fame. Think Michael Phelps. The decision on whether all 68 Russian athletes will be banned should come down by the end of the week. Knowing these Games, it's probably not the last bit of controversy we'll be hearing about before they open on August 5th. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This country's biggest public employee retirement system has posted its worst yearly returns since the financial crisis. CalPERS, the California Public Employees Retirement System, rang up a gain of 0.6% last year, not even in the same universe as its goal of 7.5%, because just like regular savers, big pension funds have been getting squeezed on their investments. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
It's been a rough past few years for savers and institutional investors alike. We've had a long period of low interest rates and a fair amount of market volatility. So says Becky Seelman with Milliman, an actuarial and consulting company.
We have more volatility and more periods where there's been more down than up. And over a fairly long period, returns have been pretty depressed.
CalPERS investment returns were short billions last year. Those poor returns are a problem for public pensions that don't invest enough to meet their future obligations. They don't want to force taxpayers to cover their shortfalls, so some make wagers on riskier long-term investments. Amy Monahan is a law professor at the University of Minnesota.
Framing it as a wager is a great way to put it. You're definitely assuming you're going to make a certain average rate of return.
Financial watchdog Ted Siddall with Benchmark Services says that quest for high returns has pushed CalPERS into overly risky investments.
In recent years, the pension has loaded up on high-cost, high-risk alternative investments such as hedge funds, private equity funds, and venture capital funds, which have performed poorly, have involved massive conflicts of interest and hidden fees.
CalPERS has backed away from some of those high-cost, high-risk investments, but Siddall thinks it needs to do better. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
The doctrine of eminent domain, the idea that it can be permissible to take private property for public use, hinges on two very important words, just and compensation. It's in the Constitution, actually. But in an oil pipeline case playing out in West Texas, who gets to decide what compensation is actually just is very much up in the air. The story comes to us from Marfa Public Radio's Lorne Madelon.
There's unfinished business in the ranch lands of West Texas.
I received this $18,000 offer and was told I had a week to accept it.
That's Jeannie Simpson. Her family settled the Barreno Ranch in the 1880s.
That tree is 100 years old, at least.
In 2014, a company named Energy Transfer of Dallas announced it would build a 148-mile pipeline from the oil and gas-rich Permian Basin of Texas to Mexico. Mexico's paying for the pipeline. It wants the natural gas to power its electricity plants.
We are on the site of the pipeline route right now.
The route cuts through this windswept slice of the borderlands, through some of the last pristine legacy working ranch land in the United States.
Because this is such rugged-looking country, people don't realize how fragile it is.
The project was designated by state regulators as being in the public interest. The pipeline company won a $770 million contract. Local governments would earn millions in property taxes paid by the pipeline company, and the state's natural gas producers would get a new market during a natural gas glut.
You're going to have big trucks hauling heavy pipe back and forth.
Because the project is classified as in the public interest, Energy Transfer has been granted the power of eminent domain, the power to take private land. Construction's begun, and so the focus now is on compensation. For landowners, it's a critical issue because pipeline construction and the heavy equipment it involves could damage a famously fragile ecosystem. Remember Jeannie Simpson's $18,000 offer?
And was told I had a week to accept it, or...
Well, Simpson and five other landowners weren't happy with the company's offers, so the company took the landowners before a special commission. The case was heard in early June in the West Texas town of Marfa. And the ruling? The commission awarded six landowners a total of around 30 times what the company had offered.
Honestly, I don't think it's possible to give just compensation. On the other hand, we have to set some sort of dollar amount and proceed from there.
In her case, Simpson's offer of $18,000 was upped to close to $700,000. Another landowner offered $16,000, awarded close to $500,000. Another offered $33,000, received close to $1 million.
My immediate goal is to receive fair compensation for the damage that's going to be done to my ranch.
Compensation judgments against the pipeline company come as a media campaign is launched opposing the pipeline. It's backed by high-profile names in Hollywood, Owen Wilson, Tommy Lee Jones, Wes Anderson. In an open letter published in the Dallas Morning News, close to 100 people, from celebrity to common citizen, appealed to Energy Transfer to reroute the project to largely uncontested land. This appeal's happening as the state considers tightening eminent domain law to benefit landowners.
And if their land is going to be taken by a private company, they want to make sure that they are fairly compensated for that.
That's Austin attorney Bill Christian. In 2011, he won a rare victory for a landowner opposing another pipeline. But in an example of Energy's power in Texas, the company was still allowed to build while its appeals went through the courts. That case will be heard by the state Supreme Court this fall. As for this case, he says the pipeline will be built.
In terms of the ultimate result of having a pipeline running across their land, that's still going to happen.
And as for compensation, he says the company has pockets deep enough to pay for legal action against resistant landowners.
In the grand scheme of what this project's going to cost, it's still kind of a drop in the bucket.
In a statement, Energy Transfer says it will appeal the monetary judgments against it if necessary. The landowner's lawyer says all six cases are likely to go to jury trials and that the landowners are ready. Meantime, Mexico is waiting for the natural gas to start flowing south. In Marfa, Texas, I'm Lorne Matalon for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, a quick follow to a story we brought you yesterday that one does have to imagine is the subject of much conversation in Cleveland. We told you about early reports in New York Magazine that Fox News chief Roger Ailes is on the way out after a sexual harassment lawsuit. Those reports are now more numerous, one might say. Variety, The Daily Beast, and others say Roger Ailes is out. Fox, however, 21st Century Fox, the parent company, came out with a statement this afternoon. It says, quote, Roger is at work. The review is ongoing. The only agreement that is in place is his existing employment agreement. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 25 points today, 18,559. The Nasdaq gave up 19 points, about a 3%. The S&P 500 gave back 3 points. That's a 10% there. Tommy Andres and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. We're talking about politics from the inside out this election season. We're bringing your questions inside the conventions and taking a look at what these political developments mean outside in our lives and livelihoods, all in our new pop-up podcast that's called Politics Inside Out. Get it on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.